Hi, I'm Ted Zoller, and you're tuned into On the Heels of Innovation, a podcast powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. How is it that some people are successful in pushing their ideas further and faster than the rest of the world? What characteristics do they share? Which skills did they work to hone? And what lessons have they uncovered through each step forward and back that can inspire you to accelerate your own ideas for a business or venture? This podcast will explore the perspectives, insights, and journeys of innovators and entrepreneurs who combine creative thinking and perseverance to go beyond the expected. On the Heels of Innovation is powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project, which is a research initiative that I lead with my students in the Entrepreneurs Lab class at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, revealing the DNA that makes up successful entrepreneurs. Well, welcome on the Heels of Innovation. We're really fortunate today to have Susan Otten with us. Susan is the founder of Indie Do Good, which is really capturing the imagination of people that are interested in social impact through business. Susan, before we unpack your story with Indie Do Good, could you give us a little bit of a perspective on your own story in your own words?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm very proud of the fact that I grew up on a farm. I grew up on a dairy farm in Minnesota, and it teaches you great lessons. You know, I did a blog post one time of lessons from my dad, and it is great because it teaches you to appreciate the land and have a respect for the environment and to be resourceful. Because farmers don't have a lot of money, and if you can fix something, you don't buy a new one. So
that's right.
That was a great lesson to learn. And then after that, I went into business. I went to University of Minnesota, graduated there in the 4-H Youth Program, which is an extension of the University of Minnesota, extension of all land-grant colleges, and did that for about a year, and then moved to Chicago, where I worked for a farm equipment manufacturer, which was a great fit. You know, it was back connected to the land and to my roots, and that was fun. But then I saw an ad in the paper, if you can believe it. Not online, not in Indeed, but on, you know, the Sunday business section for a little job at a little company called Apple Computer. And I was doing customer relationship management, meaning at the farm equipment company, if the farmer was mad that his tractor or combine wasn't working, they'd call the president of the company and they'd get me. And then I would take care of his complaint and get it fixed or, you know, figure it out. And this was a customer, similar job, customer management kind of position. I'm like, well, customer's in the title, I can do it, right? And I got really irritated because I wasn't getting a call back. And, you know, I mailed in my resume with a lovely cover letter, typed cover letter, not an email. And so I started calling the hiring manager because I figured out his phone number, and called and never could get a hold of the guy. It's like, he's got to be at his desk at some time in the morning. So I picked up the phone and got up early at 5 a.m., took a shower so my voice wouldn't be weird, and called him. And who else calls you at like 5:30 in the morning but your family because something's wrong, right? And he picked up the phone.
All right.
And I got a hold of him and I said, well, Mr. Gowans, you're obviously a morning person. Do you like coffee? Can I come see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. and I'll bring you a cup of coffee? Won't interfere with your day, but I just would love to talk to you about this position. And he was so dumbfounded, all he could do was say yes. But he said, you better bring a copy of your resume. So I did, and when I got in there, he showed me why, because the pile in the corner of his office was about 4 feet tall, and he was kind of a lazy manager, which is a great concept, and I think he hired me purely out of my tenacity, and he didn't want to read the pile of resumes. So that was great. And I was with Apple Computer for 15 years. One of my regrets is I didn't keep all of my business cards during that time, because I'm sure I would have had a full deck of 52.
With different titles.
Yeah, different titles, different
divisions.
Different
roles.
And that was part of the beauty of Apple Computer is, and one of the things I really learned as a takeaway, is how you can reinvent yourself, be nimble, be adaptable, learn from your situation. It's not, oh, gee, I got to go do this job now. It's like, wow, I get to do this job now. And I had a great career at Apple, but like all good, well not but, yes, and like all good employees of Apple, very entrepreneurial culture, I stepped out into a consultant role. And that was great. And that was my first step into entrepreneurship and being my own boss and taking what I had learned at that fabulous technology company. I was always in the areas of marketing and sales and business development and applying that and helping clients with their companies now. So that was great. And that was a lot of fun. And I probably consulted for probably 4 or 5 years, maybe even longer, as we were moving around the country with my husband's job and my kids were little. So it was perfect and to be able to do that. And but then I landed back in Atlanta, right up the road from, guess what, the third largest farm equipment manufacturer.
So So
I went back into business. And this job was great because now I was at a level where I had a global job, doing amazing, fun things, working with farmers around the world. Introduced them to this weird little concept called social media. We might be the third for the manufacturer, you know, revenue and performance, but we could be number one in social media because nobody was doing it yet. And so worked with the brands and built this system of content curation and just had a really voice with the customers, with our target audience on what kind of services and what kind of products that company was, because we had a very robust portfolio of 4 core brands and it was just a lot of fun.
I want to dig into the story just a little bit because ironically I come from 7 generations of dairy farmers as well. So I know what that means. And I'm curious, what does your growing up around the farm and the way, you know, people are trained to do things help inform your role as an entrepreneur? You know, is that somehow a pathway to prepare you to make things happen?
I think I mentioned to you when we were chatting that I have this nickname of Turbo. and, you know, not only Turbo, but the tenacity and the hard work. Because, you know, being a farmer is hard work. It is also being hugely adaptable. Because we had dairy cows and, you know, animals you have to care for, I remember many times in the middle of the night, the call would go out from somebody within the house, the cows are out, the cows are out.
Right.
And that was the problem because not only are they out wandering around, but we also, our farm was on a 4-lane freeway.
Right.
And so we had to get them back to safety because you don't want to lose a cow. So just that ability to be really adaptable and resourceful. And, you know, you also can't work by yourself on the farm. You know, you can, but it's pretty lonely, and it's a lot of work. It's a lot of hard physical work. It's a lot easier to, you know, the old barn raising days, the old, hey, I've got a big job to do, neighbor, can you come help me? And when I was, one of the observations I have about farming, too, it's the only business where you're not geographically competitive.
Right.
Now, 2 gas stations across the, you know, street from each other would be competitive, but 2 farms across the gravel road from each other, they're not competitive at all.
In fact, they cooperate a great deal.
They might share
help
equipment.
Each other.
Yeah, community. They'll eat together. They'll play together.
They share knowledge.
Yes. So it's a great industry.
So it actually is a kind of the same thing that translates into building a team.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to unpack a bit about your work with Indie Do Good. And you have the tagline, helping entrepreneurial companies do good.
Right.
Now, immediately, a lot of people think, oh, well, you're interested in social entrepreneurship or you're interested in nonprofit or what have you. But you don't have that mentality at all.
No. In fact, we have the mentality that the more good you do, the more profit you make. If you're a successful business, really, the more profit you make, the more good you can do. And not that nonprofits, of course they do amazing
great
work.
Great work.
From a commercial aspect, though, the companies we see that are in, and we support all for-profit companies, that they're doing good work. And it's not a separation of being profitable and doing good.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the companies, we have it really as a criteria of the companies we work with, that there's some element of good, whether it be environmental or for physical fitness or for charitable donations or, you know, solving a world problem, something that they're working on has to have an element back to doing good.
What was your call to action, Susan, when you started Indie Do Good? And I know you and your husband, Ron, were the champions of it, and I understand you both are very complimentary. Ron is the product development numbers guy, and you're the business marketing channels and salesperson.
Yeah.
And you're both ninjas in your own way. So you're really looking to cultivate, like you'd mentioned, just off the farm, cultivate and grow young entrepreneurs. What was your call to action, and why did you do this company at this point in your life?
So as we were looking to start a business, and we always wanted to work for ourselves, we're both really hard workers, so let's do something that we really feel passionate about and that we can work hard on the things that we want to, you know. There's limited funds that you can do to give back. Our heart is very much into philanthropy, but there's no limit to what your heart can do. And so finding businesses that we could support with our experience and knowledge was a way that we could give back, you know, beyond writing a check.
And it's actually a lot more scalable, isn't it? Well, you're probably having more impact doing it this way.
Well, we not only the impact that we have, but the impact that our companies have.
Of course.
You know, and just some of the good work that they do. And one of the companies we support, Farinita, does an amazing job of supporting over 8,000 women in 9 countries, local artisans that produce products that she helps them to design so she's sure that they will sell, but it's also that you maintain the cultural integrity of the country. So they're not knockoffs. These are beautiful handmade items. One of the best examples I can give is from Ethiopia, a war-ravaged country that makes these beautiful beads and jewelry out of bullets, the spent, you know, shell casings, because there's so much war that's going on. But the one thing that's really cool, and you talk about impact, and that you can do more by, you know, your experience and your heart, is that out of those 8,000 women that she's supporting, 52 of them now are employing other women.
Wow.
So it's kind of a pay it forward kind of thing, and she's instilling with them this kind of mission and values that is living beyond just the impact that she's having by herself. And we're helping to grow her company, because at the beginning, you know, she was doing the pick and pack, the shipping, selling one onesie twosies to consumer, and still sells that way. But now, because we're helping her with logistics and shipping and bringing the cost of freight down because of our economies of scale and better rates, she's now gone into wholesale. So she's selling to retail places, boutiques. She's going to go into other places, you know, that she wouldn't have been able to do, like museum shops and things like that, without that scalability that we can offer. And that's something that, as we look for entrepreneurs that we're trying to help, ones that do understand this kind of scalability, and that they can have a vision and a mission, they can articulate that really well, but what's beyond the first product? What's beyond the first service that they're doing? What's the product roadmap? And what's the long-term vision? Because it's hard, I think, you know, for a company. They've got a great idea. They innovate on that idea. They produce the idea and have a sellable, monetizable product. What's next? You work so hard to get that first one out the door. Is that your measure of success?
You know, it occurs to me you told the story around what you and Ron and Ben Barris, who we've interviewed on this podcast before, Ben is one of our graduates, is the third leg of your stool.
Yes.
What you do to support entrepreneurs. And I'm curious, what do you look for in, you see hundreds of entrepreneurs that are coming up with different product ideas. What do you look for? What's the X factor?
Yeah. And this is something that's evolved, because we ourselves are entrepreneurs. You know, we've been around almost 3 years now doing this, and really we've evolved our business a couple of times. So we're bumbling along. This hasn't been a slam dunk from the beginning by any stretch. And the model has changed of what we look for, because it used to be, I'm all about the money, honey. I want to see your numbers. I want to see your, you know, your performance. I want to see your forecasts. I want to see your budget. I want to see your cash flow, and just all be about the money. And then I'm like, no, that's not really right, because it's really about the product. And if you have a really great product, the product will lend itself then to good financials, right? And it'll be a good opportunity. And the most common reasons why small businesses fail is because of the leadership. So I'm going to now look at the leadership first. And if we invest in a company, I'm not going to rush to invest. I'm going to work with them for a while. And even if that means we lose some equity because I'm increasing the value of the company, so instead of buying in at, you know, $100,000, now I'm going to buy in at $500,000, but I still have that same limited amount of money, you know, I don't care. I want to make sure that the people I'm doing business are the kind of people that have the same values that I do, that they're going to listen, you know, because we're not a majority holder in any of these companies. We're minority. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even a seat on the board isn't the seat on the board. They don't have to listen to us. And I want people that will listen, make wise decisions. They don't have to, you know, it's their company. They don't have to listen to what we're doing. But some of the stuff that we bring and some of the questions we ask and the decisions we're trying to help them make, it, it helps them to listen to what we say. And that's the kind of relationship we want.
I think that's what's really intriguing about your business model is that not only are you bringing the value add of understanding how to access larger markets, getting people to unpack kind of the rigor that's needed to scale business, and also starting to understand the characteristics of leadership, but what you're doing is actually empowering entrepreneurs to actually realize their potential as opposed to trying to control a preordained path to some kind of exit strategy.
Right.
Most seed investors are looking for that power or that capability. You're both open on being a minority player and helping them do well by doing good.
Because, you know, especially the early stage ones that maybe this is their first foray into business, and the entrepreneurship programs like what you have here at UNC are just so fabulous, and they're learning so much. It still is a step of faith, though, when they leave the safety and the resources of a collegiate experience to be in the business world. And, you know, by definition, a lot of college students haven't been in the business world. And some of them, well, you know, I had a 6-month internship, so I'm experienced in the business world. Well, not really. You know, you haven't gone through a whole full year. You haven't experienced what a layoff is like. You know, there's a lot of things you don't have the opportunity to do in a internship or a short-term engagement. So, and we want to be that kind of, you know, different investor, very selective with who we invest in, you know, limited pool of money. But we want to be active, so that takes time and space and cost for us too. So we can't, we can't invest in a whole bunch of them because we want to be active in all of them and provide that kind of guidance, because what we're doing is going to live beyond us. You know, that entrepreneur, if we do our job right, either will continue with that business and continue to grow it, or they'll have a liquidity event and they'll take that money and they'll go do the next thing. And the next thing, and the next thing. And what kind of impact, if we teach them some of these values at this stage, it's just going to have this multiplier effect. And then hopefully they're also going to support other entrepreneurs too, because it's a great community. And I think that's one thing too that UNC is doing a good job of, is developing that entrepreneurial community mindset. There's lots been talked about the entrepreneurial mindset, but if you've put with that community, it's just so much more powerful. And I think you're doing some really amazing things here.
Well, thank you for that. You know, and it occurs to me there's some things about this generation that's coming up. You know, they're not even millennials any longer. Yeah. We call them post-millennials. These are people that are digital natives. And I'm curious, you know, both of us came out of the same generation and we're working with these young folks. Do you think that they have the same view of the market as we did and the way we were brought up? And I'm curious how they're teaching you something. Because you had mentioned there is no limit to your heart.
Yeah.
Are they teaching you something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I'm talking to an entrepreneur, I'm taking furious notes, and it's probably more on what I'm learning from them than what I'm learning about their company. Because I usually can remember what the company's about, and, you know, I'm watching for cues on their leadership capabilities and their dynamics with their team member. Are they collaborative? Is the leader being a leader? You know, those kinds of things. But there's so much I'm learning. And I hope they're not looking at the marketplace the way we did, because the marketplace has changed so much and it's moving so fast. I mean, the marketing has changed so much, just my discipline. I mean, the attention span of a goldfish, you know, rule now. And I had to look it up this morning to make sure I had it right, because when I'm speaking later this week, I wanted to get my facts right, so I have the source. And it was actually Microsoft that did the research on it. And it's, you know, 9 seconds. And humans are less than that. Because the last time you listened to, well, of course, not this podcast, but, watched a video or listened to a podcast, then you look down at the time bar. Well, how much time is left? And it's usually about 8 seconds before you're looking down there and seeing how much time is left. And, you know, so we are absorbing information at this, you know, fire hose isn't even a big enough, analogy. It's accelerating so fast, and the technology is so cool and so disruptive at the same time. And the one thing I'm noticing recently, and I've heard about this, but now I'm actually seeing it, is kind of the put the hands up and stop to technology that I'm seeing from the post-millennials. They're more about community. I had some teams I talked to yesterday here at Launch Carolina, and they were talking about, no, I don't want this to be digital. I want it to be, I want it to be a technology-supported solution, but I want the experience to be face-to-face. I asked him, why are you not sticking, you know, Zoom or Skype into this tool and doing it, this learning virtually? No, I want there to be a relationship built between these people that are exchanging information and going through this learning experience.
Maybe the digital native is evolving.
I think so. And there's also the theory that, you know, they're the grandma's generation of this time, that they're back to, you know, buy local, cook your meals. You know, some of the old school philosophies are coming back in vogue again because things have changed. And some of the things that have changed are not for the better. And to go back to some of the good ways, the proven ways, that's really interesting for me to see. So how does that, with the convergence of technology, make our world better? You know, GMO is bad, but a woman said it this morning, maybe modifying the species of seaweed would be a good thing, you know, if you're using it for plastics or cosmetics or, you know, whatever the application is. Just because one thing is bad with the use of technology doesn't mean that everything has to be bad with that use of technology. So I love the way technology is shaping the way we think and our time to market too. It's just, it accelerates things, it makes things possible, it makes the world smaller. We can take things that we're developing here for the United States and deploy it globally and do so much good around the world too.
And that's some of the gifts that you bring with Indie Do Good, is the ability to actually integrate globally, mm-hmm. you know, complex supply chains,
yes.
doing prototyping to production,
yes.
Building all the elements that are needed to actually take a company to scale. In my research, I'm trying to understand some of the best ways that we can prepare entrepreneurs for the marathon of, mm-hmm. you know, running the race as founders. Here at the university level. And, you know, you've been working with a number of entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. How well do we prepare them, honestly? Mm-hmm. And how does Indie Do Good help fill in the hole? And what can we do better as educators?
Well, I'm really curious about that question, too. And I've been looking for research that proves that out, because I'm trying to gather research on, are we making a difference with these entrepreneurs? Does it have an impact? And starting to gather data for a longitudinal study. Let's take a look at them a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 from year 10, and see if it's made a difference. And I think the universities are doing an amazing job. They are still universities. They're still academic institutions. Their purpose is to learn, teach, and provide the tools, develop cognitive learning for their students. And there's still that experience once you step out of the university and hit the, you know, the real world, you know, like
the market.
Yeah, it's different. And no longer do you have all these resources that are available to you for either no cost or low cost or part of your fees, you know, at the university. So they're like hidden costs. You're paying for them, but in a different way. How do you get that now in the open market? And, you know, can you barter for it? That's an emerging thing that's in entrepreneurial space too. You know, I'm a good marketer, you're a good engineer, let's get together and help each other. That's
co-found.
Really common. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The co-working spaces are one that does a good job with that. You know, you're paying for your space, but you get all these other things with it, including community and some ongoing programming in some of the co-working spaces. So that works. We still feel, though, there's a gap with, and I don't know, I'm trying to figure out if this is even possible for universities to do. I think it's a little bit outside their mission, so I don't think it's competitive with what we're doing, but I'm even wondering if it's possible for the university to do it, because it's based on experience and actually connections. In our world of supporting 3PL, so third-party logistics, how do you get a product from point A to point B? How do you design that product or service or technology, take it from an idea to producing it? Or the marketing, branding, channel development, sales process. So those things are so dependent on trial and error, what you did in the past, what you did for company, you know, A, I applied to company B, and then now I'm applying it to these entrepreneurs, you know, LMNOP. And every time you do it, you improve it. I speak in there's a joke around the office. They call it Seussisms, like Dr. Seuss. So I'm Dr. Seuss because I'm always kind of talking in these colorful phrases. But one of my favorite ones is develop once and deploy many, because you develop the core of the idea, the core of the product or the service. But as you deploy it, it gets better and better and better. And it gets more efficient as you deploy it, too. So as we learn from our past experiences, and I don't know that universities will ever be able to fill that gap because mm-hmm. they don't have that experience. Collectively, they do. And universities do a great job of bringing business people into the university to play roles or to mentor or to be part of programming. It's a little different, though, when you're working, you know, side by side, hand in hand with the company day after day, in some cases year after year, to get them to launch, you know. And then afterwards, what's the next product? What's the next problem we're trying to solve? How can you make product A a little bit different to serve market B? So there's so much of that that happens. And, you know, that's our business opportunity. That's what we like to do. And I love that they're coming to us so prepared, but there's still that gap.
With your experience of building Indie Do Good, has that experience, after having a very successful business career, when most people decide, hey, I'm going to lay back for a while and retire, you've leaned into a whole new business. Yeah. Has it made you more optimistic about the future? Or are you worried about the future?
Well, you know, one of my sayings is, you know, I'm out to change the world and maybe you should start with changing yourself first. And that, you know, reinventing yourself constantly, lifelong learning, applying your learning to other things. I mean, it gives me so much energy. I'm really committed to getting good sleep. I just think sleep is, you know, sleep and water are one of the two best medicinal, you know, products out there. But as soon as I'm awake, I start to think, and I'm working so hard at shutting that off and working with meditation and pushing those fluffy clouds of ideas away so I can just get my good sleep. But it's so hard because you want to do this and you want to do that and you want to get out of bed and you want to start your day because, you know, you're wasting time just sleeping. And so I've had to really shift my thinking and work really, really hard at that and be committed to, you know, it's proven too. There's a certain point in time. I don't care how hard you argue. You're just not as productive after 16-hour days. You're just not. Your body just, you know, we have a human limitation. And, you know, to recharge, to get outside, like, you know, the walk we did before this. The other thing I'm really concerned about, or concerned might be, no, this might be a good word, with the entrepreneurs that we work with is the well-being that they're going through. And, you know, if you ask them a question, you know, do you want to be successful? Do you want to be happy? Are those things mutually exclusive? Mm-hmm. You know, does one feed the other? What's your support system? You know, what's your diet like? How many hours a day are you working? How many days a week are you working? You know, what's your downtime? All of those things make you a better entrepreneur, and it's really, really, really hard to accept that discipline of working on yourself as well as your idea.
I feel like we're back on the farm. Yeah. We're going to loop right back. Yeah. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you work hard, but these are systems that kind of recover themselves.
Yeah.
And it creates this perpetual value creation.
Yeah, right.
You know, we've learned a lot from our experience. I know you see patterns that other people don't see. And I'm just extraordinarily amazed by the insights you have on the market. I feel like you're updating what we know as business today. Yeah. And I just want to celebrate your commitment to doing that. So thanks for what you're doing for the young entrepreneurs.
Oh, sure. Thank you.